Explore the history of Goza-style beers with the latest book for Brewers Publications. Just released, Goza, Brewing a Classic German Beer for the Modern Era, was written by award-winning brewer Fal Allen. Goza includes 27 recipes like Sea Quench Sour from Dogfish Head Craft Brewery and the Great American Beer Festival gold-winning Goza from Rubens Brews. Get your copy today at brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 6th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Steve Wilkes and I introduce a new segment, the Mead Yeast Experiment, or maybe the Mead Yeast Sampler. Steve brewed up three batches of mead with different dry wine yeasts to see if we can detect any differences and see if we have preferences between the three. Lots of fun, and lots of information, too. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other brewing gear, our basic brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, at Basic Brewing, and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us a favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that that will help new listeners to find us. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. This Friday, I'm planning to post an early release to financial supporters of an episode that my son Will helped me shoot. It's not about beer, so it's a bit of an extra episode. I have a habanero plant that's going crazy this year. I'm putting out lots of peppers, so I've been making habanero hot sauce. If you remember a while back, our friend Ed Nicholson came on Basic Brewing Radio to share his habanero hot sauce recipe that he cooked up on the stovetop. Well, I've adapted that to the Instant Pot. It's super simple, and you'll be seeing that video soon. So I love to use that hot sauce on just about everything. I had some for breakfast. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. This past couple of weeks, I think I've been reading emails about homegrown hops. Listener Steve sent me a message through our Facebook page, and Steve says, I wanted to provide some feedback to something your listener Mark mentioned in his write-up on using homegrown hops in your latest podcast. He mentioned that he dumped his batch of, quote, unpalatable sweet malt drink due to low hop bittering of his fresh hops. However, the drain does not need to be the final destination for an overly malty beer. You can use it for blending. Steve says, earlier this year, I brewed my Kolsch recipe with my brother-in-law on his system. He is new to brewing and did not know his efficiency, so I assumed low, around 65%. Our Kolsch was supposed to have a higher original gravity at 1067 by design anyway. However, the beer gods decided to be generous and bless us with an efficiency in the mid-80s. Thus, we ended up with an original gravity of 1087. This overly malty, underhopped 10% ABV Kolsch sat in a keg for a while, basically untouched, until I brewed my first Russian Imperial Stout. The Russian Imperial Stout came out too harsh for my taste, so I had the idea to try and cut it with my Imperial Kolsch. It was perfect. The beers blended very well and tamed the roast harshness of the Russian Imperial Stout. Thus, says Steve, my Russian Imperial Stout Kolsch, or Risk, was born. It was appropriately named Risky Business. Steve says, I grew up being told two wrongs don't make a right, but what do they know? Well, thanks, Steve. Great point. Always a shame to think about wasting homebrew down the drain unless it's contaminated with something nasty tasting. But it sounds like you saved a beer from the disaster show file, so good job. Hey, it's tailgating season and time to talk about the Poncho's Keg Cooler from Poncho's Brewing Lab. The Poncho's Keg Cooler is a 20-gallon cylindrical insulated cooler that's designed to accommodate a 5-gallon corny keg. It fits right in there. Poncho made these because he was not happy dealing with jockey boxes. Now, I've used mine to serve homebrew to family and friends on multiple occasions, and I love it. But think about how easy it would be to set up a keg cooler, a Poncho's keg cooler, to tailgate instead of dragging out a jockey box, cleaning all the copper in that and all that stuff. It doesn't take much ice to keep a keg cool with a Poncho's keg cooler. I recently put a couple of bags in the cooler on a Monday, and on the following Wednesday, there was still ice in there keeping the keg cold and the beer nice and tasty. So since the keg isn't sitting out in the weather like when you use a Jockey Box, your beer doesn't have to go through big temperature swings. And when you're not serving beer out of it, you can convert your Poncho's keg cooler into a 20-gallon mash tun. And right now, the Deluxe Poncho's keg cooler comes with C.M. Becker's mini regulator and adapts to fit 16-gram, 74-gram paintball and regular CO2 tanks for the same price as the Deluxe cooler used to be just by itself. And if you use the code BBR at PonchosBrewingLab.com, that's P-A-N-C-H-O-S BrewingLab.com, use BBR, you can get 15% off any cooler. So head on over to Poncho's Brewing Lab and pick out your own Poncho's keg cooler for the tailgating season coming up. Well, it's now. It's here now. By the way, you can if you follow Poncho's Brewing Lab on Instagram, you can see pictures of where people have been using their Poncho's keg cooler in real-life situations. So that's kind of neat. Inspired by Fal Allen's book on Goza, I brewed up my take on something similar last week. I did a 50-50 split of two-row and white wheat with a bit of flaked oats in there for head retention. I did a 30-minute boil with only about 5 IBUs of hops in there because I wanted to get some lactic sourness in the fermenter. I pitched some yeast I got from listener Frederick in Denmark that's supposed to be Lithuanian farmhouse yeast. The first batch I brewed with it fermented out on my porch, my front porch in the summertime heat, and it turned out nicely fruity and tart. So I took the yeast that I collected by top cropping from that first batch and I pitched it in this Goza-ish beer and put it back on the porch. Well, even though that yeast had been in the fridge for 8 weeks, it took right off and was bubbling the airlock within 4 hours. So I took a taste of the most recent batch, and it's not as tart as the previous one. So maybe there's not as much lactobacillus in this batch. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do about that. I'm going to talk to Fal soon, so maybe he's got some advice for me. So fingers crossed that this will turn out okay in the end. Stay tuned. Along with tailgating season, it's brewing season. You know I'll be brewing out on the patio with my electric brew-in-a-bag system from High Gravity in Tulsa, and when the weather gets colder and the chilly wind blows across that patio, I know that my mash rest is going to be rock solid, and the heat from my system will go right into the wort when I'm not boiling. So no more building barriers to keep my propane burner from blowing out, which has happened. No more running to the store for a new propane tank in the middle of a boil, which has happened. No more overshooting mash temps and adding cold water back to bring it back down, which has happened. Electric brewing takes the pain out of propane, and my high-gravity electric system with a Warthog controller keeps everything just the way I want it without my babysitting it all the time. And if you brew more traditionally than brew in a bag, High Gravity has 2 and 3 vessel systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels. And the folks at High Gravity brew professionally on one of their electric systems for their Pippin's Tap Room. So you know they know what they're doing, and you know that the gear is well tested. So head on over to family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com to get your new system to celebrate the coming fall. And use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's EBC75BB at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, you guys have liked our hop sampler series, comparing hops in small batches of beer, and I hope you'll like our new mead yeast sampler, too. So let's go to the house of Steve Wilkes from stevesbrewshop.com. Well, Steve Wilkes, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be back.
Seems like forever. We've had all the content from Portland and HomebrewCon. You know, and it doesn't seem like we've gotten together as much lately just because we've had all that content to go through. But we've got a couple of shows to do today. We're starting out with a mead experiment. What the heck are we doing?
Well, your brainchild of the hop sampler inspired me to do a yeast sampler. So we're going to compare and contrast three meads, all from the same must. So it's the exact same must. The only variable is the three yeasts that I chose. I chose all Lauvlin yeast, 71B, which is a very common yeast for making mead, along with the EC118, the Champagne yeast, again, a very common one. And then one that's not so common, at least in my experience, and that's the QA23. So they're all very common yeast used in white wine making. And I just thought it would be very interesting to see what we thought about the difference between the three yeasts. Mm-hmm. If you talk to mead makers, if you read mead blogs, you'll see that 71B is an extremely common and highly recommended yeast for meads. Along with EC118, you see that a lot as well, too. So I just thought it would be fun to do that. And here we are today doing a little sensory panel.
So talk about the mead. Talk about the must. What went into this?
So it was a 3-gallon batch broken into 3 1-gallons with 6 pounds of honey. So each one is 2 pounds of honey, in theory, in the must. And then enough water to make a 1-gallon batch. A little bit of yeast nutrient at the beginning. I don't have the recipe in front of me directly, but an appropriate amount of yeast nutrient. And then the yeast, and that's it. Then I allowed it to clear. They all cleared beautifully on their own. I didn't use any kind of fining agent in them.
Wow.
I did rack them from a primary to a secondary, and there are photos. I think I've already got photos on my website, but I'll make sure that they're on there once the show gets up. But I did take photos along the way so folks could see what they look like. And they all actually physically look about the same to me. So that part's okay. Then when it got time to bottle the mead, and by the way, they're 10.2%. So they all finished at just slightly under 1.0. So we'll call it 0.998 on the hydrometer. Mm-hmm. And I did it bottling because I felt like it would be a little bit more real world. I did back sweeten each one. So I used a tiny bit of sorbate and potassium metabisulfite to stabilize them, let them set overnight to take care of the yeast. And then I back sweetened them with an ounce each per gallon of wine conditioner, which is basically a simple syrup with a little bit of sorbate added into as well. And so then I went ahead and bottled them as still meads in wine bottles, corked them, and did that about a month ago. They've been in the bottle for about a month, maybe slightly longer, but at this point, but so I'll call it 6 weeks. And here we are today drinking them.
And just to clarify in my mind, this was the same must. You made the one big must, and then you separated it out.
That's right. That's exactly how I did it, so that there wouldn't be any chance of having a different must in from gallon jug to gallon jug. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I made a 3-gallon batch and then broke them apart.
And we've decided not to do the blind test out of necessity.
Because I bottled two of them. I was able to bottle in the little half bottles, and then for some reason, one of the three ended up in a full-size 750-milliliter bottle. So there's no way to really do a blind test. So we kind of flipped it on its head. We're going to talk about them, give our impressions of each one, and then we'll go back and compare them to what the manufacturer says they should taste like, more or less. Right. So we'll see what Lauvlin has to say about them and compare them to what we think they taste like. And I would say, too, that I did get a good, strong, clean fermentation. Each one fermented out within a few days of each other. As I recall, I believe the EC118 appeared to finish more quickly and appeared to clear more quickly. And as I recall, the 71B took a little bit longer to ferment, and it seemed like it took a little bit longer to clear. Hmm. By that, I mean a matter of 2 or 3 days,
right,
in the difference.
And the 118 is the Champagne yeast.
That's right.
Okay. So should we sample and talk about our impressions of the meads, the different yeasts, before we should leave the descriptors to the last to see if we line up.
Yeah. So let's just talk about them. So let's talk about the EC118. I think it's the sweetest of the three.
Surprisingly, I do too, because whenever you think about, or whenever I think about Champagne yeast, We always tell people if your beer finishes too high, put some champagne yeast in there because it's gonna dry it out. But yeah, to me the champagne yeast, this, what is it, 118, mm-hmm. Is remarkably or noticeably sweeter than the other two. And I guess I'll go ahead and say that it's my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's my favorite too. And I suppose there is always the possibility of human error that I could have made a mistake and sweetened it just a little bit more, but I don't think I did. I feel very certain that I didn't. I was real careful in how I did it, but I guess that could be the case, but I don't think it is. And I think it's my favorite too. It also seems like it has the nicest fermentation, meaning, well, the others are fine. I don't want to say they're bad, but I really like how clean the fermentation seems to be on this. There are no other flavors than the honey and then the little bit of sweetness, because it was very dry.
And it tastes fruity to me. Mm-hmm. And what was the honey?
It was a local honey from Richards at Apiaries. I get it locally. So their hives are kind of scattered across Benton and Madison counties here in Northwest Arkansas. And it's wildflower honey, not the lightest honey. It's a little bit of a light amber colored honey. Mm. And that's what I used. And it's the same honey that I sell.
Yeah, it's nice and fruity. I love the honey character in this. I'm getting no fermentation. Well, I don't get any fermentation defects in any of these. I think it seems like to me, in my palate, they all fermented well. Mm-hmm. I don't taste any stressed yeast in either of these. But it's nice and fruity. You know, it's a honey character, but it's not overly sweet. You know, it's not cloying. It's sweeter than the other two, but it's not like a cloying sweetness that is like too much. It's right. Not like a dessert mead by any stretch of the imagination. We have small samples in front of us because we have another show to get through. But it drinks really well. If this were a wine, how would you describe it? I mean, it's not a dry wine. Describe in wine terms, what is this?
I would describe it as a semi-sweet wine. Every state has different descriptors. I'm kind of familiar with how Missouri describes their wines, and so I would rank this as a semi-sweet wine or semi-sweet mead. A little bit like a sweet Riesling, a sweeter Riesling, not a dessert Riesling, but a Riesling or a Gewurztraminer. It's along the lines of those styles of wines.
Yeah, it's delicious. I don't know what else to say about it other than to compare and contrast to the other two. So should we wait or should we go ahead and
let's go ahead.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Since we're talking about this one, so the official description from the manufacturer, this was isolated in Champagne, and its use is, I'm just reading here, is validated by the big French words that I can't pronounce. But the last word is champagne. And so apparently there's an institute in France that verifies this. That's what I think. Its strong competitive character, its ability to ferment at low temperature, good flocculation, and excellent alcohol tolerance make EC-118 an excellent strain to be used in a wide range of applications, such as sparkling wines, fruit wines, and ciders. Mm. And I do know that I see this particular yeast a lot in wine kits that I sell that are coming to me from they're pre-made. And I see this one, and I'm sure that's because it's so versatile. And I think aggressive. I mean, it's going to give you a good fermentation. So I'm not sure what else to say about it.
No notes as far as flavor characteristics or anything like that?
Well, let's see here.
It's got some charts and graphs on there.
Charts and graphs. it tells you to rehydrate the yeast, which I didn't do. I pitched the yeast directly in, and I got a good fermentation. So
did you use a whole packet?
I did, actually. I used 5 grams of yeast in a gallon. So I did use a whole packet. Hmm.
So the packet of wine yeast is smaller than a packet of beer yeast?
Yeah, it's about half. Most beer yeasts are 11 grams. And wine yeast are sold in 5 grams generally, 5 or 6, but they're 5 grams. And And as I've done this more and more over the years, I've gotten to where I pitch more yeast than I would have. So years ago, I would have been really stingy, say, on these one-gallon batches. I would have pitched just a tiny amount. Or in my five-gallon batch of meat, I would have pitched 5 grams of yeast. But the more I've read about it and the more I've done it, so from my own experience and from reading, I've run across award-winning professional meaderies that will pitch 5 grams per gallon. Ooh. For everything.
Wow.
And so now when I make mead, and in fact in the kits that I do, a 1 to 3 gallon batch, we use 1 packet of yeast. A 5 gallon batch, I provide 2 packets of yeast. And I feel like that gets a good fermentation, and not over pitching. And I think that it's really important to get a good hard fermentation going quickly with mead, just like it is with beer. Mm-hmm. That the last thing you kind of want is that fermentation that takes 3 days before you see anything begin to happen. And boy, if you're going to get some funky acetone flavors.
I loved their first album.
Yeah, they were good. They were good.
Funky acetone.
Yeah. So on that, let's go to the B-side.
The Loveland B-side.
That's right.
71 B-side. Or should we? I'm in my hand here. I have the 23.
Let's do that.
This is more. It's drier than the first one, the 118. And in fact, I think it's drier than the 71 B. Spoiler. But it's a teeny tiny bit astringent in comparison to the 118. And I don't know if I had had it on its own, whether I would use that adjective or not.
Yeah.
But in comparison to the 118, I think it is a little more astringent. And I'm going to take another sip.
I think it is, too. I almost get a little bit of pepper, like a black pepper or grains of paradise kind of effect. Very, very light, but mm-hmm. but it's kind of there. And it actually reminds me more of a... actual true white wine, a grape white wine, like a Sauvignon Blanc. It's not quite as light as a Sauvignon Blanc, but it drinks much more like a grape white wine than the 118 did. I almost feel badly because now that we know the 118 is the sweetest of the three, I would like to have done that last because it kind of it makes the others seem drier and more stringent than they probably are. But having said that, I agree with you. It's very dry, and it's very dry white wine-like. I still get some honey character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. And I could drink a full glass of it and not complain. You said pepper as an, and I'm assuming that you mean the like peppercorns, the pepper as in seasoning pepper.
Yeah, black pepper, yeah.
I'm getting, and maybe it's because you said the word pepper, but I'm getting a little... like a like a bell pepper. Am I crazy? I don't know what's bringing that on, but and it's not like a vegetal off flavor kind of thing. It's like a little bright, you know, how especially the skin of a bell pepper is kind of like, you know, the kind of bright and bell peppery.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm quite struck at how different these are, and I'm quite struck at how if I was, I can see where I might want to use the 23 if I'm really shooting for a really dry wine-like product, that it would be good for that. I like this yeast, and I do make Sauvignon Blanc with it, and I use it for that. It's a Portuguese wine yeast. I don't know a whole lot about it. I've not used it that much, but the few times I have, I like it, and I decided to try it in this experiment to see how it would do. And so I'm curious about how it would perform if we had made a melomel with it. Would it dry the melomel out? Would it dry, say, some apricots out? I just don't know. And in fact, that's another variable that we can't get into really, but part of it is to just establish a base flavor that you could then take and say, well, okay, I really like how this performed, but I might like it in conjunction with some cherries or some apricots or whatever.
In swirling it up, it is rather perfumey to my nose.
Oh, yeah.
And it smells good. Is bell pepper, is that a common descriptor of white wines? I mean, this isn't a white wine. These aren't. No. It's not from grapes. But you know, is that, of course, I guess you can. It's wines have the entire spectrum probably of flavor descriptors.
Well, there's a red wine. There's a red wine grape, a French grape called Chambersin, that commonly goes to bell pepper. It goes to a green vegetal kind of pepper, and in a small amount, it's very desirable and actually quite good. In a large amount, it wouldn't taste so good. I kind of get that Chambersin level of vegetal quality in this as well. Mm. So it's not unpleasant. It's not what I expected to taste in this. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll brew some more mead with this just to play with it some more. But at the moment, between the two that we've tried, I do like the 118 better.
Mm-hmm. It seems to show off the honey better. Yeah. And I get what you, in sipping more on this, I get what you mean when you say pepper, as in the salt and pepper, because there is kind of a spiciness in the back of the tongue as well.
A little bit, yeah. And I would also say, in terms of how the meads were made, they were fermented and treated exactly the same on the same days. They were left in the same closet at the same temperature. I mean, there's just no variables in how they were handled at all. Mm. So it's not like we did the 118 at my house and then the 23 at the store or something like that that could bring a temperature variable in.
Right.
So I think that also really speaks to the differences in the yeast, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what does the manufacturer say about the 23?
Okay, let's see.
Is it 23? What's the official name?
23 Skidoo. Let me see here.
Get your papers in order.
Very jazzy. There we go. Let's see. So it says, I've got more paper in order to do it.
It's a QA23.
QA23. It's selected on soil types from the area of, man, this type is small, of Vinhas Verde in Portugal. It offers quality of fermentation, security bound to a weak demand in assimilation, nitrogen, and O2. In other words, I think it doesn't need a lot of oxygen. Could have written that a little differently. Lauvelin QA23 is an excellent choice for wine styles like Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, Chardonnay, and Gewürztraminer.
Gesundheit.
And indeed, that's, you know, so I use it in my Sauvignon Blancs and like it. So that's all I had. That's all that I've got notes on this one. They didn't have a lot of information on it. Good experiment. I think I'll try it again.
Who buys that of your customers?
White wine makers, guys that make, you know, well, I've got one customer in particular who makes Sauvignon Blancs, and he's the one that kind of turned me on to this. And then I started carrying it, and then I noticed more demand for it. So people that came in with kind of in the know. Mm. So people that are doing these kind of light white wines, people that do white Muscat wines, Moscato or Muscadines.
Oh. Huh.
Down here we get Muscadine wines. And so I've had some customers try it for that. That's who uses it. It's not by any means the biggest seller, but I've liked it in the grape one I've done, and I think the jury's still out on it on this particular one. I don't dislike it, but I think I need to find a different use for it. I guess I'll put it that way.
Maybe a higher gravity mead.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, because it really dried it out, and even back sweetening with that 1 ounce of wine conditioner, it's still really dry, mm-hmm. almost to the point of astringent. So that's interesting. Yeah.
I like Muscadine, the grapes. The Muscadine wines that I've had tend to be too sweet for me, and I think they probably do that on purpose.
Yeah, they do. I've had some really good Muscadine wine, and I've had some really bad Muscadine wine. And so that gets to the winemaker's abilities. But actually, there's a red Muscadine wine made from Chateau Ozark down on Altus, down at mm-hmm. the mountain down there. And the wine is very good. It's very strong. Mm. I want to say it gets up to the 14 or 15% range. but not a sweet wine. It's actually quite dry and heavy and red, and it's absolutely wonderful, and not at all what I expected a muscadine wine to taste like.
Huh.
So kudos to Chateau Ozark, you know.
And it's not spelled the way you would think. All right, okay. 71B.
71B.
Cheers, by the way.
Cheers.
Clunk. We're using plastic cups. Hmm. Oh. This is my second favorite. There's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. It's not as sweet as it's in the middle between the 118 and the QA23 as far as sweetness is concerned. But there are some bright fruity flavors in there. I'm thinking of cherry.
Yeah. You can convince me of cherry. It's I think it is the most complex
mm-hmm.
of the three.
Yeah.
And the sweetness level is actually just about perfect for me.
Mm.
I do like the 118, but it's just almost to the point where I wish it was a little drier. This one's just about right for me. I might switch my vote and say now that they've warmed just ever so slightly, I think I really like this 71B a lot. When we first opened it and I took a sniff of it, I thought I got a touch of rubber band.
Mm.
But that seems to have dissipated. And I don't taste that at all. And I don't know if you will or not.
No, I'm not getting...
No.
When I first tasted it, and maybe it's because I tasted the 118 first, and it's been a little while since I took a big swig of the 118,
yeah.
I thought it was a little more astringent than what I think now. But I think it's good. I think it's well balanced. It's not too sweet. And it's funny, when you swirl this one up, the 71B, you don't get that the perfume that you get from the QA23.
Uh-uh.
That's odd how that and it's the same stuff. You know, it's the same stuff fermented with different yeast, but you wouldn't think the yeast character would give it that perfuming note.
And yet I really like that perfume note in the QA23. That's really nice. You know, this could be a little crazy, but I wonder what would happen if you were to ferment with both yeasts instead of blending in the bottle or after it's fermented, blend it by how you pitch the yeast. That could be very interesting, or it could be a mess. But
like a sachet of each, little packet of each. Well, this one I think is I know that Tim Lieber, I believe 71B is Tim Lieber's standby. Tim Lieber's been on the show many times, or several times, usually when we go to the homebrew conference, and is a great mead maker. You know, and do you remember the episode where we're sitting out on the patio? Was it in San Diego where we tasted 71B and the bread yeast mead side by side? Do you remember that?
I do remember it, yeah.
And we liked the bread yeast better.
Well, we were probably drunk.
but this is nice. I think it's a nice balance between the sweetness that I'm getting, and I can't believe that the champagne yeast is the sweetest one. But the sweetness from the champagne yeast and the pepperiness of the QA23, this is a nice balance in between. I don't think it shows off the honey. I don't get as much honey as I do from the champagne yeast. But it's nice. Like I say, I get a little bit of a fruity cherry flavor from it. It's not as strong as like a Luden's cough drop or anything like that. But there is kind of just a, especially in comparison to the other two, kind of a hint of a cherry to go along with it.
I think it probably does have the most complex of the three. This is the most complex in terms of layers of flavor. It's very pleasant. This is the wine or the mead yeast or wine yeast that I use mostly when I make mead. I almost always use 71B. And so, and I tended a seminar maybe this year, maybe last year, with the Mead Makers panel. And I think every one of the people up on the stage said, well, 71B, that's what we use. So, and maybe that's, so I'm going to say that was a year ago, because I kind of came back thinking, okay, I'm going to move away from the champagne yeast that I had used historically and do the 71B.
I think that was Minneapolis.
Yeah, I think it was.
It's good. What's the manufacturer say about 71B?
All right, let's read the notes.
71 Highway 71 Business.
That's right.
Come on down.
Also known as College. 71B was isolated from another long French word that I can't pronounce. Not Maginot, but it looks like it.
That's where I draw the line.
Yeah, the National Agricultural... don't get behind it. The National Agricultural Research Institute, and then whatever that is in French. In Narbonne, France. So it's the Narbonne wine strain. 71B is known for making blush and semi-sweet wines and owes its success to its abilities to produce amyl ester.
Slow down.
I'm not going there. Reinforcing the aromatic profile of wines. 71B also softens high acid musts by partially metabolizing malic acid.
Huh.
So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a honey that has quite a lot of malic acid in it, this would soften that up. Hmm. I don't know how you'd know that it had a lot of malic acid in it. You know, if you're a mead maker, I mean, just a home mead maker, you're just going to have the honey you have. Mm-hmm. But that's very interesting.
Huh.
It's for nouveau style wines. The land quality was from Beaujolais.
Oh.
So this would be used, I assume, in making the Gamay Beaujolais wines.
Oh. So I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to take one more sip of the 71B.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the most complex flavors of all of them. There was a hint of cantaloupe in there for a second.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Take another sip of the QA23. Ooh. The more that warms up, the more I like it. the more I drink mead, the more I like drinking mead.
That's right. the secret to a good mead is get your guest drunk first.
Give them the good stuff on the front end.
That's right.
Any more thoughts on the QA23 on the second visit?
I agree that I think as it opens up and warms a little bit, it's becoming friendlier to my palate. There's a little more going on. It's lost a little bit of that pepperiness, perhaps. And the perfume is actually quite nice. And I think of the three, I completely agree with that. It just has a really nice... smell. It smells really good and really perfumey. I do still think it's by far the driest of the three.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then finally?
The champagne yeast, the 118. I just think that's delightful. That's It's bordering on being too sweet, but it's not. To my palate, it's not. Because I don't like a super dry wine. I don't like a super dry mead. I like a little body in there. We didn't talk about the perceived body between these three. I think they're pretty similar.
Oh yeah.
But I like that. I like to taste honey when I drink a mead. I don't want it to be sickeningly, cloyingly sweet.
Right.
But I do want it to taste like a honey beverage rather than a dry white wine.
I agree with that. Yeah, completely. And, well, I'm kind of on the fence about which one's my favorite now. I'm probably still between the 18 and the 71B, mm-hmm. but for different reasons. Hmm. But the 71B is the easiest drink. It's the one that just drinks the easiest to me. I'm not 71B, I mean 118.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah. So sorry, I misspoke.
Yeah.
This is very interesting, I think.
Yeah. Well done. I hope this is the first in a series of these.
Well, I was thinking, I'll go out on a limb. I was thinking we'd do the same thing, but try three different beer yeasts.
Oh.
And see what we think.
Yeah. We did a split batch of mead way back in the old days. when I made them, and I don't think I did a very good job. I don't think the. I'm glad that those aren't around anymore, so that I can taste them and say, "Ooh, these were nasty." But I would rather you do the, you know, do the experiment again, because there were some clunkers in that group of meads, and I don't think my palate was well informed enough, and I don't think I knew what I was doing with the meads to really know that they were clunkers. But I would like to revisit it with the same technique and see what some beer yeast do.
Yeah, me too. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, James.
Well, thanks again to Steve. Of course, you can find Steve at his Steve's Brew Shop in Fayetteville, Arkansas, or at stevesbrewshop.com. Great fun and a great experiment. You know, every time I taste good mead, I think to myself, I need to make another batch of it myself. But Steve keeps sharing his, so the incentive is is lower for me to make my own. after we recorded that episode, we recorded another hop sampler, which will be coming up before too long. And we were a little sillier with the second episode. Go figure. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our silicone pints. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.